and welcome to Art Worlds. Today we are joined by Esther Kote, a lecturer and a PhD candidate whose research focuses on inclusive designs for persons with disabilities. Esther's mission is to create affordable, customized footwear that meets the unique needs of each individual. In this episode, she shares how her experience in the footwear industry inspired her, how design can empower marginalized communities, and what it takes to make design truly accessible. So let's dive into Esther's inspiring journey. Karibuni. Good afternoon, listeners. Welcome to this podcast. My name is Praise Joyce. This podcast is being done courtesy of the Technical University of Kenya. And today we are honored to be hosting one of our lecturers, Miss Esther Kote. Karibu sana. Please introduce yourself to us.
I am Esther Kote, a PhD candidate at the Technical University of Kenya. My area of the PhD is creating a system or designing a system for persons with disabilities to enable them to get footwear in a way that is not expensive and in a way that co-designs with them. So it allows them to be part of the process. That way, the system is very inclusive.
Thank you. I have a small icebreaker for you. I remember the first class, you asked us what we were wearing and who made what we were wearing. So this is my chance to throw the same question to you. So please tell us about what you're wearing and if you do know who made what you're wearing.
It would have been nice if I was wearing something made by Kenyans. Yeah. Okay, I have a bracelet on, which is made out of bone, cow bone. Okay. And that was made in Kenya, actually, so that's cool. I have a scarf on because it's extremely cold. I think the government has taken away the heat. This I got from, I think, Woolworths. My dress, striped blue beige, is from Truworths. Mm-hmm. And the sweater, I got it, I think I was abroad. I cannot remember where. Mm-hmm. If you see the label, maybe you can tell me. My shoes are from Bata, not Stars, plus the socks, actually. Yes.
Okay. Our first question, I'd like you to tell us, how long have you been lecturing and how would you describe your method and style of teaching?
I think officially I started lecturing maybe in 2013. As a part-time lecturer here at Took, actually, I was told something very interesting by one of my students last semester. They say, do you teach like a mentor? It's not the normal form of teaching. And it's very interactive. Yeah. So I'm not here to just drop information on you as a student. The point of my lessons and how I teach or my methodology is you remember. Mm-hmm. 5 years from now, you remember, 10 years. And I'm always happy when my students tell me that, oh, I still remember how you taught us this. If you've noticed all my classes, I take feedback from students every single class I teach. And I've always encouraged students to be extremely open. So students are usually very honest.
Yeah.
And I always say that my current students are enjoying the fruits of the feedback from the previous students ones, because then they would tell me, you give us too much assignments. Mm-hmm. And of course, what they love, because I always ask, what do you love? What needs to change? What needs to remain the same? Okay. And that allows me then to continue tailoring the lessons towards what the students want, as opposed to what I assume the students want.
Awesome. Yeah. Next question. What is one thing that you would advise students to, you know, just having a great pin-up in terms of also presentation skills and things like that?
We need to think globally, then execute locally. That means you need to start looking at how people are doing exhibitions. Mm-hmm. And I always give examples of platforms where you could find how other people, creatives, are doing exhibitions globally. We have a habit where you, as a student, you come 2 minutes before pin-up time. You just put your work on the wall quickly and you run away from it. Yeah. I wish we could push ourselves in such a way that when we do our exhibitions, it's no longer just classwork. It's literally you showing your work to the world, and we can make it almost like an actual showcase.
I think one of the reasons, speaking from our experience, is that basically by our system of education, you are supposed to do maths, English, physics, you're supposed to choose from this subject. There's no space for that free thinking and just doing your own diversity. The next question would be, referring to your time working at Bata, how was it being a woman, the youngest female, first production development manager and a senior manager? Was your environment quite male dominated in that kind of setup? How did you step up up your game to be like, I'm here because I offer value.
I always say my time at BATTA was amazing. I literally had the most unique experience there, honestly. I was brought in because I was a graduate trainee. Mm-hmm. So it was a graduate trainee program. Okay. They were trying to make me grow within the company to become leadership mm-hmm. one day. It was a very crazy experience, I have to say. Mm-hmm. I used to go to work. It was so funny. And as I'm walking in, I'm just seeing a group of men. There's a guy from France, guy from Bangladesh, guy from CG Sheik. Mm-hmm. They are all walking angrily towards my department. So I'm like, oh no, my day is going to be fire. And these are people with experience. Esther, we told you this is not working. The factory is not working. So imagine you don't have the experience. Mm-hmm. You don't have necessarily the knowledge. You're supposed to be training and you're running the department. So I learned very quickly on the job. And I feel that's a very important thing for designers to be able to do, to learn on the job. Mm-hmm. Men are interesting. I think women, we grow up and we are told we are very emotional.
Yeah.
Then you work with men. We would have meetings where shoes would be thrown on the table. What do you mean? What is this? But it was very entertaining. Yeah. And the funny thing is this. It also taught me not to take things personally. Uh-huh. Manufacturing is intense. So you'd fight in meetings, horribly fight. Then after that, you go sit in each other's offices and you're like, hey, where? Today? So you've seen fire. And you start laughing.
Yeah.
In a meeting, someone will say, send the email, send it. So you go sit and you type a very furious email. Then you edit it nicely. Kindly send to me as we discussed. So you really learn also professionalism. Mm-hmm. Like for me, that was a fantastic experience. When I say I can work well under pressure, I truly mean it.
So on to the next question. The Olympics 2024 is happening. The Kenyan team recently unveiled their uniforms and the feedback from Kenyans was very negative. It was so bad. Do you think that in the future, in such cases, top Kenyan designers would be given that space to design uniforms for the Olympics team, mm-hmm. or should they just keep it as they did recently? They just opened it to, you know, the best submission. It was like a competition. What do you think about this?
Design is very tricky because when you're designing as an individual, making the decisions tends to be very quick and it's easy. But mm-hmm. then you're working with the government. The government works like mm-hmm. a Titanic. When you want to change things, especially for the better, you make the change today, then you'll see the change probably 5 to 10 years, if you're lucky. Because you have to understand politics is usually heavily involved mm-hmm. in such decisions. In this case, I think I am one of the people who is 100% for mentorship. We need to provide platforms for young designers to be able to also make their name and experience how it is to design for a national team or for an international organization, you know. The Olympics would be such an amazing thing for you as a designer to have your name attached to a design. Mm. One, for sure, I feel it's okay to call in designers in a competition and ask them to submit mm-hmm. work and pay. Mm-hmm. Currently, the prize money feels a bit on the lower side. Yeah. I feel it could be higher, so we could work on that. But yes, give young designers a chance. Maybe the last thing I would say is this. Mm-hmm. Places like the UK, America, they pay brands like Tommy Hilfiger millions of dollars to design their uniforms, Nike. So why are we in Kenya treating this like a very small thing? Mm. If you're going to treat this as something that is just a joke, it will end up becoming a joke.
I am learning from that, especially the point you say that working with government is Titanic. You will turn it, but you will see the effects later. So I think we'll just get to the next question. Tell us about your PhD. Of course, we have an idea. It's about people with disabilities. So why narrow down to these people with disabilities? Why this specific group?
I do design that changes lives. Mm. I think that's one of the things I want to do. If it's not changing lives for the better, then what's the point of me doing that? When I was working at BATTA, we would get people requesting for customized footwear. Most of them are PWDs, but PWDs meaning persons with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So for me, over time, I started to think, how can we solve this problem? I started to notice this is an issue. Mm-hmm. And every time we'd get a customer, I would sit with them, we would have a conversation, and I'd ask them, so are you able to get this anywhere else? And they would say, imagine there's really no place I can. Mm-hmm. Sometimes maybe I import from abroad, but then it's expensive. And they would say they've been recommended from the hospitals like Kenyatta or organizations that deal with disabilities. Mm-hmm. So it was a challenge. We would always make the shoes, by the way, because you feel like, oh, I have to help.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, you help someone today, five people come tomorrow. Yeah. Bata is a mass producer, millions of pairs of shoes per day. So making just one or two pairs is not good. Even for the department, the leadership would always be like, hey guys, you have to finish this other work. So this started to feel a bit like we are doing a favor. So my PhD, hopefully, creates a system that it's no longer a favor. One thing about designing for disability is that it benefits every single person. A simple example, doors that slide open without you touching them, they help everyone. If you're carrying things that are heavy, the door will slide and you'll walk in and you're like, oh, thank God, I didn't have to put my bags down to open. If you're carrying a baby, if you just don't feel like holding a handle, you're good. But then for someone who is in a wheelchair, it changes their lives so much better than everyone else. So designing for disability at the end of the day makes life better for everyone involved, actually.
So how do you plan to involve persons with disabilities in the design process for their customized footwear?
That's now my methodology where I'm fleshing it out. Mm-hmm. I've been part of a training that is currently ongoing for inclusive fashion. On Friday last week, we had a focus group with persons with disabilities. Mm-hmm. And that already is a co-designing process. You're already involving the user in the process from the beginning. Disabilities might look similar, but every single person has very particular challenges. So once you work with someone from the beginning, you know, there's this process where we usually say you do research, you identify your target audience. If you notice, you rarely go to talk to the target audience. Yeah. But with disability, it becomes very different because you have to speak to every individual particularly. Mm. And that's why I think systems, they've had a hard time including persons with disabilities, because it's very hard to design for mass production while considering every customized need. When I'm blind, for example, my needs for footwear might be completely different from someone else who's also blind, because levels of blindness are different. There are those who have blindness, they can see the outline, but then they can't see the details. But then there's someone who's just seen complete black or maybe complete white. So how do you deal with those kind of differences? The lady who had blindness, she told us she loves to match her clothes. We were like, eh? What do you mean? When we were having our discussions in the training, we'd say, oh, they like black because black won't show sweat. She's like, what do you mean? My favorite color is white. We were like, what? And in fact, that day she came, she was wearing white and black, but she had matched it perfectly. And she's like, I use textures to help me figure out colors. Wow. And then I work with particular tailors and they tell me this is this color and it's going to have this texture. We were like, this is a whole system. Yeah. You never think of those things when you don't have that disability. So imagine now I'm able to put all that information into my PhD in a way that everyone can access it quickly. Mm. And if you're dealing with someone who has disability, you can now learn quickly how to do it. Mm. So if, for example, texture is what allows you to know what color, we can just have a universal code. Blue is texture like this. So when you wear it, for you have no disability, you really don't care. Yeah. But for someone who has disability, they're like, this is blue because this is a texture universally. So that kind of thing is what I hope to achieve.
I saw you wrote pilot studies. So what are pilot studies?
I want to work with practice-based methodology. So practice-based methodology is one of the best ways we feel for those who are practicing to be able to work with a PhD and prepare a dissertation or a paper without it being too theoretical. Because the scientific method assumes you'll just write a paper and then you submit. But what about us, where we use practical means or processes to achieve our end game? If we are able to document the process, then write a thesis at the end of it and exhibit our work as we go through the process, then it allows us to make our areas become in a way like scientific method. Practice-based methodology for me is what I want to use. So the whole process of designing, I use it while documenting it and then put all that together, of course, critique it, analyze it, and then it becomes my dissertation. In the research area, a pilot study means before you carry out the main research, you work with a smaller group of people and you collect data with them to understand what challenges will be there. It helps you improve your research instruments, things like questionnaires, surveys. You edit them to now become better. Once you conduct a pilot study, it allows you now to say, this is okay, we go to the larger group to conduct a study. But then in design, we also do pilot studies. For example, I design shoes. Imagine 40 48 million Kenyans wearing these shoes. Before we take it there, we give 10 people and they walk with those shoes and they keep coming back to me every day or maybe every week. And they say, ah, Esther, you know, this calf strap is hurting my leg here. Maybe the sole is a bit too narrow, make it wider, that kind of thing. There's pilots in terms of research, and then there's pilot in terms of design process. So in my research, I'm able to put both together.
In what ways do you think that your research could influence policy decisions and inclusive practices in the design industry?
Every time a policy is made, do we think of people who have disabilities? Not really. My research is hoping that anytime any change is made in any area, I'm concentrating on footwear, right? But the hope is that once you have this system here and it's in place, anyone could just refer to this system and say, okay, this is for footwear. However, what if we want to turn it into agriculture? PWDs are very marginalized. Inclusive design literally means everyone is involved, including those who are marginalized. And in a way that it's no longer a by the way or a favor. You know, the way for us in Kenya, we say, I need to donate clothes to those who have disability. We should not be doing that because that is out of the kindness of your heart. What if everyone one day wakes up and they're not kind? Will they never get clothes? So when you include it in policy, in the law, in the constitution, it allows for them to be taken care of without someone waking up and feeling like, oh, yeah. I feel kind. It becomes the way life is. Whether someone feels they're kind or not, it is working.
So alongside our guest, Miss Esther Kute, we are also joined by Madam Jackie. I would like her to introduce herself for this next part as we also dive deeper.
My name is Jackie. And alongside Praise, I'm going to be interviewing you regarding the psychological aspect of your PhD. So now this will be a bit personal. What does having a PhD mean to you?
Let me start with why I'm doing a PhD. One of my mentors, who's now actually my supervisor for my PhD, mentioned when I was in undergraduate, you could be a very good lecturer. So that was a seed planted in my mind. I did my master's research almost immediately after I graduated from my undergrad. I was working so much. I completed it in a hotel in Kolkata in India at 3 a.m. or 1 a.m. Imagine. A PhD becomes maybe 100 times harder than a master's. People are involved with your master's, but with your PhD, no one is really involved. Your supervisor will guide you, but it's a very hands-off way of supervision. At some point, you'll want to give up. You'll be like, why am I suffering? Life is too short. Let me just enjoy. And then something will happen that will trigger the spark back again. You become excited about the most weird things. You'll read a tweet on social media and that will be the thing that makes you say, oh my God. And you go write like 10 pages of your work. It's such a weird journey. I think for me, I've always wanted to teach. And one of the requirements for teaching in Kenya is you have to have a PhD to become a proper lecturer, proper professor. So for me, I think that's one of the motivations. The other motivations is it's just one of those things I've wanted to do. Just self-actualization. Whether I end up using it or not, it will just be like, I've done the PhD and I'm good to go. Also, the fact that I have a passion for the area I'm studying and for design, I guess that also helps me because I'm publishing in journals, in books, I'm attending conferences. So I think that's also helping me understand what I'm doing is actually important. So that makes me keep going. And the PWDs themselves, on Friday, they were like, we want you to make those shoes. Don't forget. So you can see, so actually this is making a change.
There's something you've mentioned, the way the PhD has affected all aspects of your life. Do you feel like your life has been disrupted since you started your PhD? And I want to tie it to another question. Do you practice any self-care?
Self-care is very important. Going to the spa, massage, those treatments, they help relieve the tension that you're holding. We hold tension in our body, and we usually don't realize that tension can lead to some health issues if you're not careful. So you have to take care of your body. Of course, hanging out with family. You know, when you do family events and you're there and you're just chilling, talking, that thing. I notice that really helps release my tension. One of the best advice I've received in regards to a PhD is don't force your body to work in the way you want it to work anymore. If you're tired, sleep. Even if it's at 2 p.m., sleep. If you wake up at 1 a.m., and that's the point where your body tells you, work on the PhD, then do that. sleep until your body is not tired anymore. I've been practicing that and I've actually found it works very well. Give it time to rest and then get back to it pole pole to write a sentence per day. Before you know it, you're writing a paragraph, and then before you know it, you've done a whole chapter. And then you call your supervisor to be like, I've done a chapter, oh my God. Yeah, celebrate.
So now, I'd like you to envision something. The point where you finish your PhD. Paint that picture for us.
The day I submit and they say, we have received your work, I'll go for a spa date in Dubai, first class, because I've submitted my PhD. Hopefully by then, God, I should have money, please. For me, that's what I see.
I'd encourage you, just put it somewhere in your room when you wake up and look at it and say, I'm doing this PhD in order to go to Dubai. Manifest that.
Please.
It will happen. It will happen. First class is no problem. Yeah. You can even book now and keep just changing the date.
Yeah. Okay, I pray. Please pray for me, guys. Where? It's not easy.
But you, we know you. You're going to do it. Okay. Yeah. Then I'll stop there. Thank you so much for your time. And thank you for sharing your insights.
Thank you so much, Mrs. Stakute, for joining us and sparing your time to be here, for being free and just to pour out your research and your insights. Thank you again. And thank you again, Madam Jackie, for also joining us. I think this is where we end at. Goodbye.